Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Addiction Unlimited podcast, where you get to learn everything you want to know about addiction and recovery. I'm your host, Angela Pugh, co-founder of Kansas City Recovery, life coach, and recovering alcoholic. To learn more about me, you can listen to episode zero on your podcast app or find us on the web at addictionunlimited.com. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Addiction Unlimited podcast. I'm your host, Angela Pugh. Thank you for taking some time to spend with us today and listen to the pod. I really appreciate you guys. I've gotten some more awesome reviews on Apple Podcasts. Thank you for that as well. And I hope you guys are loving the new Facebook group too. And I'll see you over there and we can chat more at the Addiction Unlimited Facebook group page. So today we're going to be talking about trauma and some different modalities. This is some stuff that really I wasn't very familiar with, which is of course why it was fascinating to me. So I want to welcome Yolanda Harper to the show of Harper Therapy in Tampa. We are recording in Tampa today. So let's welcome Yolanda and learn some more about her.
Hey, thank you so much for having me, Angela.
Thank you for coming on and doing this with me. I've been looking forward to this. I'm so intrigued with this ART. So I'm going to let you, because I will butcher it. So I'm going to let you explain to everybody exactly what that is and what you guys do at Harper Therapy.
Yeah. So ART is an acronym for Accelerated Resolution Therapy. Accelerated Resolution Therapy is an eye movement based therapy that's super effective for addressing trauma, anxiety, depression, insomnia, chronic pain, a whole host of things.
When you say eye movement based, is this similar to EMDR?
It was actually birthed in EMDR. So the founder of Accelerated Resolution Therapy was trained in EMDR, which is another eye movement based therapy. Although in EMDR, they use other forms of bilateral stimulation too. So maybe someone has had some experience with EMDR and has done some tapping or has heard some tones, put some headphones on and heard some tones in their ears. But the developer was trained in EMDR and just kind of tweaked it and found that the way that she tweaked it was a little bit more effective. So that's where ART comes from.
What are the, or what is the evidence base? What is whatever? How does it work?
Right.
The tones in your ears. Right. Because there are all these different things that I have seen that have surfaced. Right. I even have one called BAUD therapy, B-A-U-D. Mm-hmm. But what is the thought process behind, like, what is the tone in the ears and eye movement?
Yeah. So I'll speak more specifically to the eye movements and what we know about the eye movements, but it's all addressing the nervous system, right? Because when we have had traumatic experiences in our life, it keeps our nervous system on guard. We are in high alert. So the tones and the eye movements, we call it bilateral stimulation because it's addressing each hemisphere of the brain, the left and the right.
Okay, so that's what bilateral refers to.
Yeah, that's the bilateral part, right? So whether it's the tones in your ears, we believe that the eye movements themselves are a little bit more effective. Again, it has to do with the occipital nerve and the, you know, the way that where that hits in the brain.
Right.
So it's really allowing the left side of the brain to communicate more effectively with the right side of the brain. And that's the back and forth.
Okay.
Whether it be with the tones in your ears or the eye movements.
Okay.
With your eyes moving back and forth.
That
so
makes
it really
sense.
Is your eyes moving back and forth. We kind of think in some ways it replicates REM sleep, which is that dream state of sleep where our brain is attempting to process, and why when there's been trauma, oftentimes the sleep is very disturbed and there are nightmares, right? Because the brain is trying to process this event that happened. So we use those eye movements. And when you're in that REM sleep, your eyes kind of naturally move back and forth if you've ever watched someone sleep. So we, you know, we believe that the eye movements back and forth, it's a different kind of eye movements. It's more of a smooth pursuit eye movement than the kind of bouncy that happens during REM sleep. But again, we believe it allows the brain to process more deeply, more effectively.
So one thing I heard some years ago is that trauma is accumulative. Is that accurate? Am I remembering that correctly? And how does that work?
Yeah. So what we know with the research is that when you've had a traumatic experience, just you are more likely to have subsequent traumatic experiences in your life, right? And then if those events are not processed, right? So the way that our brain stores these traumatic memories is that instead of filing it away in long-term memory storage, you know, like I ate oatmeal for breakfast 3 weeks ago on Tuesday.
Right.
Right. these distressing memories are filed in that fight, flight, freeze amygdala part of the brain because your brain's job is to keep you alive, right? Mm-hmm. And so the brain and filing it away in the amygdala that keeps you kind of on guard and making sure that you're safe keeps those memories really close to the surface.
Right.
And then anything that looks like, sounds like, smells like, tastes like that event is going to trigger that memory and going to put you on guard even more, right? So that's why a sudden noise or a certain smell
right.
might kind of trigger it. So in that way, it is kind of cumulative, right? In that it kind of starts to pile and build.
Right. Okay, that makes sense. That makes sense. So obviously I'm an addicted person mm-hmm. and I personally think almost everybody in the world probably has some trauma, you know, because there are all these things. I feel like people think when they hear the word trauma, they think really big, significant things, war, sexual assault, right. you know, things that are horrific, violence, right. awful.
Yeah.
But there are all kinds of everyday life events.
That's so important to talk about because you're right. I found that in our practice, we specialize in trauma, right? But a lot of times people don't resonate with that because right. they think I haven't been to war or I haven't,
yeah.
right? All of
yeah.
these big things. And you're right. We have those big T traumas and we have what we call the little T traumas, those things that happen to all of us in our lives. And we know just with studies like the ACEs score, the adverse childhood experiences, that when we have those certain things, having parents who are divorced or having absent parent or having a parent who has been incarcerated, being subjective to domestic violence as we're growing up. So those
addiction,
are just some addiction, right?
Sure.
Mental health issues in a caregiver as we're growing up. So all of those are examples of traumas, car accidents, anything that makes us at fear for our own safety and well-being or the safety and well-being of someone that we care about is the definition
that,
of its trauma.
I stress that so much with families right. too, because people really don't know that. They really don't have that understanding. And,
yeah.
and I was the same way. Even when I got sober, like when I was newly sober, certainly before I did any of this as my profession,
yeah.
you know, my knowledge was very limited.
Mm-hmm.
And if you would have asked me if I had trauma, I probably would have said no.
Right.
I didn't think I had trauma.
Right.
And because I didn't have any of those big horrific things happen to me.
Right.
But as I started to learn more
mm-hmm.
and started to understand really what it is and what it means
right.
and how it works, I was like, oh gosh, I
right.
got all kinds of stuff going
right.
on.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's interesting. Even natural disaster, that was another one I heard because I've lost two homes to fire.
Absolutely, yeah.
And yeah, like all of that stuff.
Right.
Car
and
accidents.
It's a threat to your safety and well-being
right.
and your livelihood. Yeah.
Or
yeah.
or the safety and well-being of someone you love.
That you love.
Yeah.
Right. So someone or something, mm-hmm, right? Because mm-hmm. our pets fall into mm-hmm. that as well, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah. You know, and when someone else doesn't get to define what your trauma is, right?
Yeah.
Your
yeah.
response to an event.
I think
is
I
the
just
definition
never
of trauma.
I just never would have classified those things as trauma.
Absolutely.
You know,
we don't.
I was more going like, what the heck is wrong with me? Because
right.
I haven't had these big things. Like, what's wrong with
right.
me? You
yeah.
know?
Right. And so then when those pieces start to fit together, you're like, now that makes sense.
Totally makes sense.
Right? Which is what's so amazing about you doing this podcast and having these conversations, right? So that other people are like, yes, that makes sense, right?
Totally.
I'm on edge. I'm irritable. I have a hard time sleeping. Relationships are always a challenge, right? I am always on edge. I hear every noise. I can't sit with my back to the door. Those types of things.
Interestingly, I was just in a conversation not long ago. So I have a fair amount of trauma. It mm-hmm. has certainly piled up over the
right.
years. And definitely as a result of active addiction, you
right?
know?
Yeah.
So one of the things, I was just in this conversation not long ago about sleep.
Uh-huh.
And
yeah.
sleep is a huge struggle for Absolutely. Addicted people.
And
for
people
whatever
with trauma.
Reason. And for people with trauma.
Yeah.
Right. So somebody said, we were talking about sleep issues and trauma. And I can't remember exactly how they worded it, but I swear they were like telling my story.
Right.
In this, like, I don't sleep. I have not slept well since I was a young person.
Right.
I've really just come to terms with it. I guess it doesn't bother me that much anymore. You know,
yeah.
I'm a very productive person.
Right. Right.
But what I notice is even when I'm quote unquote asleep, I'm never really asleep.
Right.
I feel like I am almost always in some state of consciousness. Like I am aware of every single thing that happens.
Right.
Whenever my dog moves, any noise, anything.
And again, that's your nervous system on high alert, right? Which is why some of the most effective trauma treatments use those tools, that bilateral stimulation, to help calm the nervous system, because we can't process things when we're in high alert. Our brains don't work that way.
Right.
Your brain is in fight, flight, freeze mode.
Right.
And I just wanted to circle back real quick because you made the comment, like, I had my traumas and then I had the traumas after the trauma and through my addiction. Right. And that's exactly what happens. Right.
Yeah.
We have the state of being where our nervous system is always triggered and on, right? And we can't like shut it off at all. So it makes total sense that we're going to turn to
substance,
right? Drinks, drugs, whatever,
yeah,
to help calm the nervous system,
right?
To help kind of turn that dial down a little bit.
Just like mental health, just like depression, anxiety, like all of that. So it's just interesting. Like, I've been sober a long time now, and it's just interesting to learn more and more and see how all these pieces fall into place and how my life starts to make some sense.
Right.
And then you
start using the substance, right, to kind of turn down the knob on your nervous system. And that leads to a whole different set of complications and issues and traumas.
Especially when you try to get sober.
For real, right? Because then it's right there, right? I mean, there's like no...
And your anxiety is super high because you're used to having this lubricant, right? I was used to having alcohol anesthetize me so I could go into social situations and I could date.
Yeah.
And I mean, sort of, if you call it that. I certainly wasn't successful at it.
Yeah.
But you know, like I had this anesthesia and all of a sudden it's gone.
Yeah.
So my anxiety was through the roof.
Well, and it's really interesting because I have had so many clients come in, and again, the eye movements are part of this. The eye movements are very calming to the nervous system, very calming to the body. And so many times people have made the comment, oh, I feel so relaxed, like I'm high, right? And I'm like, well, this is nice because you're not high and you can use these eye movements anytime and they don't have the negative side effects.
And maybe you'll want to come back.
Right. But again, it helps to calm the body because there's a reason that people start using, right?
I mean,
that's part of the reason
that
people start using. And when we realize that there's another way to achieve that, like, okay, I can turn that down. I can turn that anxiety down, right? Then there's hope in that, right? Then I can, at least I have another tool to face all of this stuff.
Yeah. I think too, even getting to the place, I know for me and my sobriety, even getting to a place where I didn't feel like my world was ending, you know, even like when I was triggered in my anxiety or whatever, when I got to the place finally where I didn't feel like it was the end of the world, you know, where I could start talking myself through it and talk myself off the ledge and be like, okay, dude, it's okay. Let's just figure it out. Talk to somebody.
Right.
Like I could actually start using the tools.
Right. And that's what I love about accelerated resolution therapy as well, because we can use the therapy to process these events. So, you know, say someone has had a traumatic experience where they've experienced the death of a loved one and subsequently have turned to drinking, drugs, whatever, right? As you process that event and you identify some tools, part of the therapy is to practice using those tools or to practice that different way of interacting in your life with the eye movements. And what we know is when we visualize things, that creates neuropathways in our brain towards that behavior,
right?
That's one of the reasons Ryan Lochte is such a great, you know, Olympic swimmer, is because he's had that visualization process as part of his training. And we can do that with the added benefit of the eye movements during a session.
Interesting. I had a client many, many years ago who had major trauma. Mm-hmm. He had some people follow him home from a bar one night, force their way in his house, beat him literally almost to death. mm-hmm. left him, mm-hmm. stole his car, mm-hmm. took off, and mm-hmm. had been on a slew of medications for right. a decade. Yeah. Right. I mean, everything. Yeah. Antidepressants, anti-anxiety.
That's usually what
mood
we see.
Stabilizers, right. like everything.
Right.
And this literally, it was probably 8 or 9 years ago, and it mm-hmm. was my first exposure to EMDR. Mm-hmm. So I heard somebody talk about EMDR. Mm-hmm. I read a little bit about it and made a referral for him mm-hmm. to explore EMDR, mm-hmm. and he had the most amazing results.
It's phenomenal. And again, since accelerated resolution therapy is kind of a cousin of EMDR, what we have found in the research that we've done here at the University of South Florida is that about 3 to 5 sessions, people have significant relief. If not, you know, they're sleeping better, they're able to come off medications.
Right. He had huge relief even after his first session.
After the first
session. But he said he was exhausted.
It is.
Yeah,
it
he
is.
Said he was really worn
it's
down.
Like a workout for your brain.
Yeah, and he said like he went and he rested. Like he went, I want to say he left his first session. It was like 4 or 5 p.m. Mm-hmm. And he called me to tell me, you know, how it was or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I think he like went to bed then and slept straight through the next day.
Yeah.
And he just said that he felt really exhausted, but then was like this whole other wave of relief and relaxation. Yeah. And well, he did fairly quickly go off his meds.
Right. Especially with such a significant trauma that you described.
Right.
It's not entirely common, but it's not uncommon for it to be. It's heavy lifting mentally mm-hmm. and emotionally.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Because, you know, we look at trauma as an emotional and memory. Once that memory gets filed away, right, where it needs to be, right, because those guys aren't coming after him anymore,
right?
So it's not benefiting him to have to be kind of held slave to that memory. But it can be a little bit of a workout to get to that end result. But able to sleep through the night. I use accelerated resolution therapy here in the practice, and then on combat warrior retreats, in the progress that we see those participants make over a weekend. You know, they come in Thursday and they leave Monday, and they're sleeping through the night, and they're, you know, not having to take their benzos and, you know, those kinds of things. So it's pretty remarkable. I've been doing it for years, and even after all of this time, and it's different. You know, a lot of times people are like, I don't know, that's kind of weird. And it is, but it's effective, you know?
Yeah.
And one of the biggest benefits is that people don't have to talk about their trauma. Because, like, by definition.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Right. By definition, our traumatic events are not necessarily things that we want to talk about, you know? Being raped, that's not something that I want to go into great detail about.
Sure. Right? Especially not on a regular basis.
Right.
So, do you have to, because we talked about that visualization piece, do you have to visualize mm-hmm. your mm-hmm. trauma?
So here's the thing. Our brains are doing that anyway.
Right.
Right?
I love the brain. I'm so obsessed with the brain. It's so
fascinating.
Good.
Yeah. It's so fascinating. And so our brains are doing that anyway. So what we do is we use the eye movements to help calm sensations, to help calm some of the intensity that visualization process. So we're breaking it up, but it's like what I tell clients is just imagine that you and I are sitting in a movie theater together and you're just you're playing through that as you do anyway, right? And we're going to break it up. And when I ask you to focus on that movie, then you'll focus on that event, that movie, that scene. And when I ask you to focus on sensations that are happening for you in your body, I'm going to ask for you to do that. We're going to use the eye movements. So none of that becomes so overwhelming that you feel like you got it like jet.
Right.
So that's a little bit of the process, but it is, we're asking you to actively visualize that, so that we can use the mechanism of memory reconsolidation. So it's, you know, when our brains recall a memory, it becomes malleable. So when we recall a negative memory, make it malleable and combine that with a positive experience with the calming of the eye movements. And then we ask your brain to, you know, to give a positive image and a positive scene to replace the negative image in the negative scene. Your brain always will know the facts,
Right.
You'll always know the facts. But then afterwards, remarkably enough, when you think about it, you think of the positive image instead of the negative image. And that means your body is so much calmer. You're not like the trigger is what happens in your body, right?
I refer to this in my life. I always talk about my recipe for recovery, right? So at some point when you get sober, sobriety becomes much less about not taking a drink. You know, like it's just not about not taking a drink anymore. Now it's about my recovery and becoming a good human being.
Right.
And a huge part of my mission is there's this thing that's floated around for years and I just love it. And it really is what I strive to do in my practice and all my work is, you know, the point is not to be sober or quit drinking. The point is to love myself so much that I don't want to drink, you know, and that's what it's all about to me. And I have my recipe.
Yeah.
So everything that you just described is what I call retraining my subconscious.
Right. Absolutely.
So that's what I do because I get so frustrated. Like people will come see me in my practice and there's so much out there about thinking positive and have positive thoughts and all of that stuff is wonderful. And I practice all of it, but people get frustrated because they're like, well, it's not working. I'm trying to think positive thoughts and it's not working. I'm like, cause we got to go deeper. Cause this is about your subconscious, you know, it's running the show.
I love that because, you know, there are some longstanding therapies like CBT, cognitive behavior therapy. And kind of the thought behind that is change your thoughts, change like everything in your life. Well, that's great. But especially with trauma, our thoughts don't get first dibs, right? Our emotions and our body responses, that's what gets first dibs, right? Yeah. When we're in that fight, flight, freeze state, we're not thinking about how to file our taxes.
Right.
We don't have access to that part of our brain, you know?
We don't have access. Interesting because I'm so logical.
Right.
Right. And I think in my sobriety, I have kind of trained myself to be that way because feelings to me are not trustworthy.
Right.
I cannot base my decisions in my life on my feelings.
Right.
Because they're largely inaccurate and they change really fast.
Right. And when we process the trauma that the feelings are based on, the thoughts automatically change. So that's what's really, I mean, there's so much that's amazing about the brain and this therapy. But as we're processing through a traumatic event, those negative cognitions, as the brain processes the event and the body calms and the brain's calmer, the cognitions automatically change to, oh, well, I do want to love myself enough to not take the drink.
Yeah.
Right? And this is what that looks like. Or, you know, it wasn't my fault that my loved one was killed.
Right.
There wasn't anything that I could have done, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
So those are just some examples of
the brain part, the neuro part of addiction for me in my early sobriety was the first time that I felt like I was fixable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like understanding the brain process and what happens and how it files things and it is malleable and how it will change and grow to support you in new behaviors.
Right.
Like understanding all those things was the first time that I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Like I can do this.
Right.
Like if I just keep doing this stuff long enough, it really becomes who I am.
Yeah. 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 It's hacking your brain.
My family
said I hack people's brains and you know, that they say that tongue in cheek, but there's an element of it that, when the brain is able to process things and file things away. And, you know, I say, you know, just to remind people, like your brain's had you had a lot of practice with this other behavior and we're creating this new pathway to the new healthier behavior. And I love what you said about loving yourself enough, because that is definitely the practice of self-compassion. That's, you know, something that we incorporate here in our practice too. So that combination of addressing the trauma, filing those memories away where they need to be so they're not impacting your daily life and your relationships. And then this practice of self-compassion and loving yourself like, you know, like we love our pets and that we love our dear friends, right?
It's so good. Tell us a little bit about what the actual process is if somebody comes in for ART. Like, are you talking about, do they have something on their eyes? Are they wearing headphones? Like, what does that look like?
So when someone comes into our office here at Harper Therapy, and we're doing an accelerated resolution therapy session, I will sit kind of catty quarter just off to the side. And as they look straight ahead, I am moving my hand back and forth in front of their eyes from left to right. to help facilitate that left-right eye movement. Then we alternate between my asking them to focus on sensations and emotions in the body, right? And that's a new thing for people too. I think especially with addiction, we get so tuned, we get so used to like turning that off. So this is a process of reconnecting with the body. It's a very mindful process. It's a very meditative process. So I'm asking the client to notice what's happening in their body from head to toe. And these memories get stored all in our body. There might be some different pains that come up. You know, the sensation, a sensation in the neck or a sensation in the stomach. So we'll calm the sensation, but we're also kind of throwing back to the brain, hey, brain, this is a sensation that's coming up in response to this memory, right? Right. So go ahead and process this sensation.
And this is what they talk about, how you feel different emotions in mm-hmm. different parts of your body.
Right.
Okay.
Right. And even those memories are stored in different parts, right? So just as an example, I fractured my ankle a few years ago and it's healed fine. But now sometimes when I'm coming, because I was stepping down a stair when I fractured it. Now, sometimes even when I'm stepping downstairs, there's a sensation that happens in my ankle that I'm like, that really is my brain's way right. of saying, Be careful, pay attention.
Right.
Right. So we're processing those sensations. And then we're asking the client to play through that memory and we break it up so it doesn't become too overwhelming. Right. We go at the client's pace.
So there's no blindfold goggles.
No, nothing like that. I have done these sessions throughout the world really. And all I need is just two chairs or
it probably seems floor. Like a weird question, but because I think like I and probably because of my traumas, like uh-huh. I wouldn't be comfortable if there was something right. if somebody said, yeah, come into my office, we're gonna do this therapy, and they thought they were gonna blindfold me, like that's not gonna work.
Sure. Like, totally.
Like I'm out at
totally.
That point.
And like even so I even let clients know that I'm moving closer to them, right? Because it's more helpful the closer that I am, but I'm also recognizing like part of your trauma could be invasion of your personal space.
Sure.
And I don't want to get hit. I know it's just a natural response for you to protect yourself. So I let clients know, like, I'm going to move my chair closer to you. Is this okay? You know, does this feel comfortable? So like I said, the client doesn't have to go into detail about what I've done total sessions where I don't even know what we were working on. Yeah. I have no clue what the client was processing. All I do is say, were you at the beginning, middle, or end of your event?
When we have these other modalities mm-hmm. or what, I don't really know what to call them, mm-hmm. Like the BOD, and there are a couple of others that I've seen, certainly in Kansas City. I know there are a couple of people using different things that don't require, like I said, I have the BOD myself, mm-hmm. that don't require a master's degree or training or whatever. Mm-hmm. Are these things that can actually work? Because really I got the BOD, not so much to use with clients, but to use for myself.
Right. That's the distinction between using those tools to calm the nervous system and then processing an event or a memory. So I will even teach clients how to use these eye movements themselves to process sensations.
Okay.
And for them to help get to sleep. But I don't want you processing any traumatic events at home on your own.
Right.
So that, right. please save that for, you know, a session, right?
Yes.
You know, even as a trained clinician,
I also
don't
want to be processing traumatic events at home.
No, I mean, because that can go very badly.
I have no business trying to do any of that on my own.
Even as a trained clinician, I would not dare do that for my, I know how that can go badly. Right.
Yeah.
So.
But I'm glad you made the distinction too, that it can help with the sensation.
Yes.
Right. Like that totally makes sense to me.
And we have to have these tools.
Yeah.
That's one of the reasons that people start using. We have to have some kind of tools.
Definitely.
To help calm the nervous system, because otherwise you want to crawl out of your skin.
Especially
right?
when you're brand new. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And sleep is something, you know, I have men's sober living houses and this sleep conversation is just something that I'm in nonstop. Right. Yeah. Everybody struggles so much to sleep.
And we can incorporate that into an art session as well. Like even the difficulty sleeping we can address with ART. Yeah. So if that doesn't naturally start to change after you process traumatic events, then we can do a session based on just the difficulty in sleeping, because that can be a combination of trauma, but then also it's also like habit, you know?
Yeah.
So over time, your body, you just get used to not sleeping.
Like I fall asleep. I can fall asleep. No problem.
Right.
But when I wake up, like if Henry wakes me up in the middle of the night or something to go out, if I wake up just too much, just enough for my brain to engage,
kick on.
Like once my brain engages, it's over.
Right.
At that point, it's running the show.
Right.
My brain requires a lot of information to make it happy.
And
I just can't calm it, you know? And I have a million things that I do now that I've just practiced over the years. You know, I might turn on a meditation on YouTube on my phone and listen to it.
And here's the cool thing too, is that in session, as you're presenting your brain with this problem of not being able to go back to sleep, your brain will in session give you some ideas of some other things that would be helpful, things that you do and you're using, and maybe some things that you hadn't thought about doing or that you've used in the past that have been helpful. So that's another cool thing.
It's interesting you say that too, because we talk about that in entrepreneur world.
Mm-hmm.
We talk about that visualization and really spending time with yourself and being quiet, because your brain will give you ideas. Your brain will guide
you.
Same thing in sobriety, right? Meditation's a big part of sobriety and recovery.
Right.
And same thing, like ask it. I say this to one of my guys at one of the houses all the time. Like ask your brain. It will tell you. It will give you the information.
Yeah.
You just put the question out there and then listen. And pay attention. It will tell you.
And that's the cool thing about the eye movements, is that, again, it allows that deeper communication in the brain. But it also, the eye movements help give your brain something to focus on, right? So that's part of the little brain hack there too.
Yeah. So like for me with drinking, I always said I had to drink just to quiet the noise in my head. Like it's just so freaking noisy in there. There's a whole committee in there just like talking over the world's problems every day.
Right. And so here's a cool thing about accelerated resolution therapy. It's very metaphorical. It's very dreamlike. So hearing you say that, I would say, okay, let's get an image of what this committee in your head looks like. And let's see who's on this committee, right? And just sets of eye movements to answer that question and to see, you know, where things go from there.
Yeah.
I'm always following the client's lead and where the brain is guiding me.
Right.
So,
Now I have to do something to not engage with the committee,
right?
Because my brain is always going to chatter. That's just part of it.
Right.
It's just how it is.
Right.
For a million reasons. And so like, that's why for me, I'll turn something on, like a meditation. I have to have something else to focus on.
Yeah.
So it doesn't focus so much on what it wants to focus
on.
Or for years it was, I would fall asleep with the television on
because
I'd have to put on something just mindless, nothing I wanted to be engaged in, but just to hear until I fell asleep, and I'd set the timer. It would shut itself off. But because I can't let it engage too much.
Right. So one of the questions that people ask is, if I've had several events that are kind of similar, right? So if I've been in a situation where there's been ongoing trauma or relationship abuse or whatever, right? Do I have to do a different session for each of those
events? For each event. Oh, yeah. Interesting.
So another cool thing about this therapy is that it has the potential to generalize. Because, again, remember, the brain stores trauma as anything that looks like, feels like, sounds like, smells like, tastes like,
right?
An event. So after we process the first time an event has happened or the worst time, then we can say to the brain, okay, all of those other times that something similar happened, all the lookalikes. Let's go ahead and take care of those too.
Oh, that's so good. Such a great question for addicted people too. Mm-hmm. That's such great information.
And in specifically with addiction, we can go and look at that first time, that first use, that first drunk, right?
Mm-hmm.
And process that as an event.
Oh, I just realized something when you said that. My first drunk was its own trauma.
Right.
Yeah. I'd never even thought of that, but it really was. Like it was a bad situation. Yeah. I did not like it. I did not drink for many, many, many years after.
Right.
I was not one of those people that was like, from the first drink, I loved it. I did not have that experience.
Right. So we can go back to that event, process it, and allow you to see yourself engaging in that situation in a different way.
You know what I thought about when you said that, like traumas happening over and over again, I thought about with the opiate epidemic.
Yeah.
And like so many of the opiate addicts, like that live in my houses and stuff,
right,
all of them have lost mm-hmm. numerous yeah. friends and yeah. loved ones right. to opiates, right. overdose, dying. Well,
and that's ongoing.
That's the first thing I thought of. Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's the first thing I thought of in the over and over, like mm-hmm. having to deal with something yeah. over and over, is that loss.
Yep. Because those are traumas too.
Yeah. Especially if you see it, because that happens a lot too. That'll happen right in front of people.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So are these therapies also something that insurance covers?
It depends on insurance and it depends on the clinician that
okay.
you're seeing.
Okay. Yeah. I always wondered that too, because they classify so many things, like sober living is considered a support service. Insurance doesn't cover support services. Coaching obviously is a support service. Right. So I just wondered if it was something that actually had some necessity or that insurance companies view it that way.
It depends on the insurance company right. and, you know, each of them is so different and from state to state, they're so, sure. so different.
Sure.
And so,
but
yeah.
some of them do cover it. So it is possible.
It is possible. And you okay. might be able to find find clinicians who do yeah. accept insurance.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But on the flip side of that, I will say that a lot of times people come here, we don't take insurance,
mm-hmm.
but the treatment is so effective that people spend less time and money here
sure.
and get better results than they have on, you know, on in
talk therapy other, for yeah. decades. Oh, yeah,
for sure.
Well, for sure with trauma.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So
what are some of the co-occurring things you see? Like obviously addiction, uh-huh. but what are some of yeah. the, like for me in addiction, yeah. always trauma, mm-hmm. but I can see other addictions as mm-hmm. well. Sex addiction, gambling, absolutely. Gaming, yeah. mm-hmm. Internet for sure. Social media, right. those things. Mm-hmm. Like what are some of the common co-occurring things you see?
With trauma?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, definitely sleep issues, anxiety, depression, you know, yeah. All of the
and, relationship all of the, issues.
That is primarily what gets people through the door here.
Yeah. Yeah.
People don't come saying I have trauma. People come saying my partner's ready to like jet because yeah. They can't stand being around me anymore. Or I'm yeah. irritable. Or so usually the impact on relationships is the catalyst that helps people come through the door for treatment.
Interesting. I would say the same thing with addiction yeah. too. Oftentimes mm-hmm. legal or relationship
right.
is what gets people through
right.
the door.
Yeah. So definitely relationship issues. Shame is huge with trauma and with addiction. You know, yeah. that shame is like, I'm not worthy of love and belonging. I suck.
Yeah.
I'm a miserable human being. Those kind of, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, differentiating between shame and guilt, whereas, you know, guilt yes. is like, I did something that's outside of my integrity. So a lot of shame, which isn't, you know, a technical mental health diagnosis, but it it's impacts huge. Us yeah. in such a big way.
And addicted people have that so strong, too. There's oh, such yeah. a sense of shame.
Oh, yeah.
And I get it. I think I never got super connected to shame for sure, because mm-hmm. I just feel like I really honestly feel like my drunk person is a whole separate person.
Right.
And in my sobriety, like even from early on, I don't yeah. carry all the drama yeah. of my drunk person.
That's
because
awesome.
It really wasn't me.
That's awesome.
It wasn't me
yeah.
at all. Like
yeah.
I would never do those things and behave that way in my clear state of mind.
Right.
You know, it's
yeah.
just a whole different person.
That's really cool that you
But
are,
I mean, listen, I could be that person
that.
Again.
Sure. Yeah.
It'll right. only take one drink.
Right. Right. Yeah.
But yeah. I don't know. I just really separated those from the very beginning.
That's cool.
I think also like I always had this understanding of, I feel like addicted people want to think that they are only who they were in their addiction.
Right.
And that did not make sense to me.
Right.
From early on, I was like, but wait a minute. I was this whole human
being. This whole
being
other person, right?
Long before I ever had a drink.
Yeah.
And I was really fantastic.
Right.
I was a young person,
and that
but
person
I was fantastic.
Counts. Yeah. Yeah.
And
yeah.
I also have like the greatest mom that has ever lived.
Oh, awesome.
And she built her children on these foundations that mm-hmm. were so good mm-hmm. and so strong with so much integrity.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought, well, that's who I am.
Yeah,
like really in my core.
Yeah.
Like
well,
all that stuff got covered up,
right.
but I knew it was in there.
Right. Well, that's where, you know, in the mental health field, we look at situations and we're like, what makes a person more have more of a propensity towards trauma as opposed to someone who's been through the same experience and doesn't,
right,
is not impacted in the same way. And what you're describing is part of that. Not that people who don't have, you know, strong relationships with caregivers or whomever, mm-hmm, right? But definitely having those solid foundations and that solid, you know, sense of self,
yeah,
is helpful for coming back up out of the pit.
Well, I think you forget, because mm-hmm, I'll say that to clients or whoever. I say the same thing. Like, remember, you are a whole human being, yeah, long before you ever had, right, a drink or a drug, yeah, right? Let's think about that person. That's who you really are in your core. Right. That's who you truly are.
Right.
And I think you just forget because you do have so much guilt and, right, and a lot of times shame, right, right, for those things you did in your addiction. Right. It's like you can't even believe it yourself.
Right.
And then how will you ever repair that? Like, you, right, really do. You kind of forget you were, yeah, a whole person before that. It's, yeah, so all-consuming, yeah, addiction,
exactly,
is.
Exactly. And it's like that telescope on that and that part of yourself instead of kind of pulling back.
Right. And it sucks in everybody. Mm-hmm. Like, it takes everybody's energy. Yeah. It just becomes the focus of everything.
Everything.
It's like, yeah, you got to remember that you are a whole person before, yeah, and you'll be a whole person after.
Right. Because again, that circles back to the hope that you were talking about earlier, right? There has to be hope that there's possibility for something else.
Yeah.
Otherwise, what's the point?
Yeah. And if I feed and support my brain properly,
right,
absolutely, I can get there faster. Right.
And all of those things help with the process of trauma recovery and addiction recovery.
Yeah.
Those well-being.
They really, I do feel like they go hand in hand. I, mm-hmm, read a statistic that said something like 90% of people with addiction have trauma.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
which I mean, absolutely makes sense. But like, right, I said earlier in the podcast, like, I feel like almost everybody has trauma,
yeah,
because there are so many, yeah, just regular life things that you can internalize as trauma.
And here's something that I is really important for me to, as it's a passion of mine to have conversations about mental health and recovery from these difficult experiences. And a lot of times people think that they're at their worst of their worst when they reach out for help. And that is like the getting up process. That is the bravest that you can ever. My hat goes off to anyone who is willing to pick up the phone or willing to walk into an office. Though that is like courage.
It's huge.
It's,
yeah,
huge.
Yeah.
That's not you at your weakest. That is you. So much.
But we feel so broken.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's that brokenness. Like, we keep trying to do what we've been doing until we realize, oh, this is not helping. Yeah. This is not working.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I know for me as an alcoholic, one of the things, like, it was really hard just conceptually to get to a place to understand that I really couldn't do it on my own.
Right.
Because of this whole, like, it's a liquid in a glass.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, right, it's hard to think that it really runs the show.
Right.
And it's hard to think that you can't figure out how to have power over,
right,
it.
Right.
You know, like, that's a really hard thing to get to.
Right.
And we just, I don't know. I always say alcohol will beat you into submission every opportunity,
right,
you give it.
Yeah.
It will humble,
relentless,
you.
Yeah.
It is relentless.
Yeah.
Yeah. Every,
yeah,
chance you give it, it,
yeah,
will win.
Yeah.
It's like I had to fail so many times,
right,
and I've never had a relapse since I quit drinking, right? I just celebrated 13 years,
yeah,
a month or so ago.
Thank,
yeah, you.
That's awesome.
And I've never had a relapse in that time.
Right.
Before I got to that space of really understanding, like,
right,
oh, wow, okay, wait, I get it. I really can't ever have a drink, ever.
Ever,
yeah,
ever,
like,
means ever.
Okay.
Never.
And it's like I had all these little moments where it was, mm-hmm, sinking in a little bit at a time,
right,
you know, and I quit drinking once for 30 days. I quit drinking a second time for 60 days. Neither time with the intention of quitting forever.
Right.
That was never my thing. It was,
right,
just, I got to take a step back,
right,
because I had been so out of control.
Yeah.
So you want to regain your control.
Right. And this will take care of it. And then,
right,
I can go back.
And,
yeah,
all the thought processes. Like, I so,
mm-hmm,
understand when people relapse, because that's exactly what I did. After the 30 day time, I remember thinking, okay, cool. Well, now I've proven to myself that I don't have to drink every,
right,
day. Now I could just drink on
powerless
special occasions. Yeah, right. I can just drink on special occasions,
right,
and whatever. But the thing is, there is a whole biological piece that's right. at play here that is completely beyond my control.
Right.
And I don't know when that phenomenon of craving is going to kick in or when the obsession is going to kick in.
Right.
And like, this is what I talk about with clients too, when they think, so one of the things we struggle with people who are primarily drug addicts, mm-hmm. oftentimes they think, okay, I can quit doing heroin, but mm-hmm. I can still drink because right. drinking wasn't my thing. It right. wasn't my primary addiction. Right. So we have these conversations a lot and it's mm-hmm. like that it doesn't really work that way.
Right.
Because even if you could do it a few times or mm-hmm. something and not get crazy out of control, you have an addicted brain.
Right.
And there is a process that's happening
right.
in there.
Right. That whether you switch over to shopping or sex or right. whatever the next addiction
whatever
is.
That's yeah. exactly right. Yeah. And we talk about that a lot too, how yeah. those other addictions crop up.
Right.
Because I will always be an addicted person. I have yeah. to watch all those things.
Yeah.
You know?
Absolutely.
And when I was a less healthy person, boys were certainly their own sort of addiction right. for me.
Approval, right?
Right. Yeah. Acceptance, companionship, yeah. right. all, and using it for the high.
Right.
You know, I really use dating to get that high yeah. that you get from it because yeah. infatuation feels amazing.
Yeah.
And I have to be really conscious of that. Even as an adult, I have to be very right. conscious of that.
Yeah. And I think it's something that as a society, we have a struggle with just knowing our inherent worth. Our inherent value and sure. worth as human beings, right? Without the likes and the acceptance and the yeah. infatuation and all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. I know one of the things I love in my recovery is recognizing that I have a tendency to use outside things mm-hmm. to manipulate how I feel on the inside.
Right, yeah.
And just having that awareness allows me to really catch myself.
Right.
In all my things.
Yeah.
Right.
When
I'm sliding, I'm like, uh-oh, wait a minute. We're not using that properly.
Right.
you know?
And it gives us the space and the ability to adjust and course correct.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then it gives you so much more comfort in your life. And yeah. as a person.
Yeah. Peace and happiness. Connection with yourself. I think a lot of it comes back with that connection and love and acceptance for ourselves and being a good friend to ourselves.
Yeah. Right. Like how come nobody teaches us that?
Right. And that's the self-compassion piece that we bring in, right? Are we being a good friend to ourselves?
Yeah.
Right.
You know, there's something we talk about too in coaching with affirmations and all mm-hmm. the stuff that I mm-hmm. talk about retraining your subconscious. Mm-hmm. It's so interesting because when you think about your self-talk,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and that's one of the things that we focus on.
Yeah.
It's like, could you imagine the things you say to right. yourself?
You
could
you
imagine walking
never.
Up to somebody and saying yeah. those words to like right. your best friend? Like
so,
never.
Yeah. So with self-compassion, there are three components, right? There's a mindfulness component of just pausing and saying, oh my goodness, this is a moment of suffering without building a brick wall and without diving in. Because those are the two extremes that we usually
right.
go into, right? So pausing and saying in a mindful way, this is a moment of suffering. It's not going to last forever, but it's extremely right. painful right now. The second component is common humanity. I'm not alone in my suffering.
Yes.
Other people suffer like this. You know, other people have different flavors of suffering, but I'm not alone in suffering. Part of humanity is suffering. There are people in my life that can help me in this moment of suffering. But then the last component is that talking to yourself, that being a kind friend to yourself. And when I'm talking with clients about these different, you know, aspects of self-compassion, usually that being a kind friend to yourself is the most difficult one. So, you know, like, what do you say to yourself in moments of suffering? Most of us say, suck it up. What's wrong with
yeah,
you?
Right, right.
You know, and much more less PG rated, you know,
yeah.
Versions of those things. And yeah, what would it be like if we... It's a whole different ball game when we start saying, you know,
just to have the awareness.
Yeah.
It changes so much.
Yeah. And just to say, you know what? It's okay. You can get through this. And I'm a strong person.
It's funny too, because I wonder at what point, and I see this so much with clients and stuff too. I wonder at what point do we get to this place where we expect everything to go well. You know, like there's this weird sort of entitlement that we get so upset
yeah.
when things don't go our way or when things are right. uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, it's life. It's not, it doesn't always right. feel good. It's not always easy. That doesn't right. mean we stop.
Right.
Yeah. It doesn't mean we quit trying. Like, just so, get through it. Like, you figure it out. Well, keep moving.
It's that concept of suffering and that, you know, we all go through pain. Pain is part right. of the human condition, right? The suffering is optional. The suffering is right. our resistance to the pain, right? This yeah. our suffering yeah. is our response that this is not as it should be.
Yeah.
Right. But you're right. It's interesting. Where did we get that?
Where did we get it? Of, yeah.
You know, if I'm a good person, then things will go well. Right.
One of my girlfriends was just talking to me about this yesterday about dating.
Yeah.
And she just had an experience that was disappointing, mm-hmm. you know, and she's like, am I supposed to just give up? Like, mm-hmm. maybe I'm not supposed to be with anybody. And,
right.
and I kind of laughed and I was like, well, I get where you're coming from. I go, but if you think about it just in a numbers game, like 99.9% of people you date, it's not going to work out.
Well, and think about this, because we've said everyone has had some level of trauma in their lives, right? So you have this person with their own trauma coming together with this person with their own
yeah.
experiences and traumas. And then, you know, we think that that's going to be smooth sailing all along. Like, after those endorphins wear off, after that initial courtship.
I hate it when those endorphins wear off. <I know. laughs>
Wouldn't it be nice if they could just stay around forever? But again, that's not real life either, right?
Yeah. And yeah.
Like,
I just feel like each time something doesn't work, mm-hmm. to me, it's just one step closer to the next thing that's going to work. Well, so I'm like, okay, cool.
That's
yeah,
the difference
we're getting
between,
closer.
You know, a set mindset and a growth mindset, right?
Yeah.
A fixed mindset and a growth mindset where, you know, resiliency and grit is that, okay, that was plan A. What's plan B,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And so if you ever have an opportunity when you're visiting Florida to go to the Thomas Edison Estates, that's phenomenal, because Thomas Edison was like a grit guy, right?
Yeah.
I don't remember how many patents the man
right.
held, but every patent was the next step towards what he was really trying to get
right.
to, right?
Right?
He's like, I'm trying to make a light bulb and this didn't work, but I can take this information from this
yes.
and move in this direction.
And so, that's how you create your life. Like, you take information
life.
From all yeah. those different experiences.
Oh my goodness. And so I recently started playing the violin. Just kind of
nice.
Out of nowhere. I was like, I want to learn a musical instrument, and why not the violin? So I try to do something regularly that kind of stretches me outside of my comfort zone.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking violin. I'm thinking this beautiful, I'm going to make beautiful music.
Naturally, what I thought about is, oh my gosh, your brain is probably so happy.
Well, that too,
it's
right?
getting stimulated
yeah.
and something
yeah,
new.
Yeah, I'm learning something
yeah.
new. Yeah, so that's part of it too, right? So I have a violin. Her name is Violet. I have these beautiful dreams of Violet and I making beautiful music together. And in reality, it sounds like dying ducks. It's just, it's not like...
But this
how
is
do you
so
get
good
past
because
this
it's
part?
Practice.
That's exactly
that's
why I do it.
Yes.
That's why I do it. Because
and that's what life
I have
is.
To figure
it's
out
practice.
How to make my way through this discomfort of
yes.
it not being what I want it to be.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
So.
But if you keep at it, you naturally get better at it.
At some point.
It's the same thing in life. It's the same thing in sobriety.
Yeah,
like
right.
it takes practice.
Right.
I practiced
We get good
being,
at what we practice.
Yeah. I practiced being a drunk for a lot of years
that's,
and I was
yeah.
really good at
right?
it. It was second nature
yeah,
to me.
Yeah.
And in my sobriety, I had to just start practicing all different stuff.
And when we engage in our lives from that practice and from that state of curiosity, it kind of takes some of the pressure off, right? Because I can say, okay, I'm going to practice the violin for 15 minutes. And
yeah.
parts of it are going to, you know, and the funny thing is there are a majority of the time that I'm like, oh my gosh, it sounds like a dying duck. But there are those moments that I'm like, oh,
yes.
I played my first song. I played Mary Had a Little Lamb,
nice.
You know, so.
A sense of accomplishment.
Mm-hmm,
I love
yeah.
that.
So along the way, we have those moments and it's being able to recognize right,
yeah.
when we're in those moments and give ourselves a break. Right?
Yes.
When we're practicing something new.
You have to recognize
to be a good friend
moments.
To ourselves and say, look, you're working really hard at this. You're doing a good job. You're making progress.
Yeah.
Recognize the progress that you're making. I have a cowbell here in the office where when clients do something like new and brave, right? And practice this new way, they come in, they tell me about it. They ring the cowbell to celebrate. We got to celebrate those, that progress. We got to recognize it. We have this goal. You know, I have this goal of being some concert violinist.
Yeah.
And I think none of the progress counts until I reach that goal. Well, that's hogwash, you know. It's allowing ourselves that in our journey. Because that's part of life too.
The joy is in the doing.
Uh-huh.
It really is. Yeah. It's in the doing it and practicing it. Yeah. And that's where the joy is.
Yeah. And finding our own way in that, right?
Yeah. So. I love that. Well, Yolanda, thank you so much for doing this with me.
Thank you.
This has been an awesome conversation. I'm glad my listeners got to hear all of this good stuff about trauma and different things.
Yeah.
And for the listeners, on Yolanda's page in the show notes, we'll have all of her contact information, all that good stuff for you guys as well. And we will see you next week. Thank you.
Thank you.
You've reached the end of another great episode of the Addiction Unlimited podcast. Candid and honest conversation about addiction and recovery. Be sure to visit us at addictionunlimited.com to join the conversation and access show notes and links to everything we talked about. Love this episode? Please take 30 seconds to subscribe, rate, and review on iTunes to help us improve and give you the information you want. Thanks for listening. See you next week.